Hello, and welcome to Doing Social Research, where I talk with some of my favorite people who do social research to dig into the cool projects they're working on, along with the struggles and successes they've had in their careers. My goal is to help demystify research for students, help other researchers hear stories of others' wins and losses, and provide a platform for all the brilliant work of folks doing research in the humanities and social sciences. I'm your host, Phyllis Rippey, professor of sociology at the University of Ottawa and creator of the website doingsocialresearch.com. I've been teaching research methods for over 15 years and have carried out my own sociological research using both qualitative methods and advanced statistics. But today we're not here to talk about me. We're here to talk with Tyler Escott about what we should be thinking about sex in terms of research and why we need to just sort of let ourselves think about sex. So Tyler is a current and former graduate student of mine. After getting a bachelor's of sociology at Toronto Metropolitan University, Tyler came to the University of Ottawa to complete a Master of Arts in Sociology with a specialization in feminist and gender studies, working with yours truly. The thesis was entitled Making and Managing the Discredited Victim, Reproduction of Sex Work Stigma in Canadian News Media Reports, 2010 to 2019. And I'll also say that even though another podcast guest I said did amazing and was nominated for an award, Tyler also did amazing and was nominated for an award. And I just have to say, even though both of them did, that's a very rare thing. And so it is like Tyler's work is just absolutely phenomenal, phenomenal thesis. And I want everybody to read it. Now he's also begun a PhD at the University of Ottawa in Feminist and Gender Studies. And for this, his tentatively titled thesis is What's a MILF Got to Do with It? Mother Figures in Popular Internet Pornography and Embracing Pleasure. So Tyler, welcome to my podcast.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm very excited. I'm a little flustered at that introduction. The level of kindness is absurd.
I'm just spitting facts here. This is not kindness. This is just truth. I want to ask, what got you interested in studying sex as a research project?
I basically am obsessed with pop culture, mm-hmm. and I noticed that sex is absolutely everywhere, mm-hmm. but we seem to sidestep sex when studying pop culture. And then I realized we sidestep sex whenever we study anything. Mm-hmm. So I thought, let's maybe turn into sex instead of turning away from it.
I love it. I love it.
Focusing on it so deeply and at points very excitingly.
Let's start with your master's thesis, since that is a completed project, as much as a project ever is completed. So what did you do for that?
So basically for the master's thesis, I combined two forms of media analysis, looking at broad content as well as more micro discourse, trying to find the ways in which stigma was reproduced in news reporting about sex work policy and how these fit into very familiar narrative frames that show up in a lot of storytelling.
Can you tell me a little bit more why the time period that you talked about? So you were looking at these news reports from 2010 to 2020-ish, right? 2019?
Yeah, basically that decade of the 2010s.
Yeah, why that decade?
I was focused on Canadian news reporting, and during that time, starting in technically 2009, but they really ramped up in 2010, a lot of changes to sex work policy in Canada, mm-hmm. and this really monumental court case called the Bedford case that went to the Supreme Court, where the Supreme Court decided to side with sex workers finally and attempt to get sex work provisions removed from the criminal code.
And so what was it? Sorry to interrupt you. So what was it before that? What was like the law? Like, is sex work legal or illegal? Like, what? Tell me really, like, talk to me like I'm five, but don't talk to five-year-olds maybe about sex workers.
Sex work was technically legal, but activities surrounded by sex work was illegal. So you couldn't operate what was called a body house, which is any building that sex work occurs within. Mm-hmm. You also couldn't live off the avails of what the criminal code called prostitution. So any money that you made from sex work could not be used and could not be shared. Like, so confusingly ambiguous, and it's known as like quasi-legal sex work, where there were, the act itself was legal, but then everything you get from it was illegal.
Okay, and so some you could, of the spaces, so could you pay someone for sex work?
At that time, yes.
Okay.
But then after the Bedford case, the government had to act to either change or entirely decriminalize sex work.
Okay.
They chose to switch around the criminal provisions and decided to criminalize the purchase rather than the act of sex
work. So you had said a minute ago that this was in the court ruled in favor of sex workers. So yes. How does that, like, what were the sex workers fighting for and what happened with the case?
They basically argued that these criminal code provisions were against their charter's rights. And they said it was unconstitutional that they had such restrictions on their work. And so the court, at the end of the day, accepted this.
But they criminalized the purchase of sex work. Is that
right?
Yeah.
So after this, the Canadian government, at that time headed by Stephen Harper, decided to introduce what's called the Protection of Communities and Exploited Persons Act, where they treated legal sex work with human trafficking violations alongside of one another and framed those that purchased sex in a similar way to framing human traffickers.
Right. Now, that doesn't feel like it sides with the sex workers.
Not at all. It just kind of like reproduces this idea that sex work is inherently exploitative, which it is not.
It's, right.
And that was really the point of my thesis. I wanted to really make a statement that the sex work that was being kind of stepped around in this policy didn't consider the lives of sex workers whatsoever and just framed them as these exploited beings that had no agency.
You were saying, talking about stigma, and I think like that's kind of a word people use a lot, but can you like define it and talk a little bit about sort of the sociological understanding of stigma and who talked about these ideas, and tell me a little bit more about stigma and how that relates to sex workers.
Yeah, stigma has kind of been a little popularized in a way that oversimplifies it. But the sociological foundation of it comes from Irving Goffman, and he just simply defines it as a discredited attribute of one's identity. So in any situation, somebody's identity or a specific marker of their identity is different from what is considered normal in that space, and that will attach discrediting attributes, and they will be stigmatized. That's so, very much oversimplifying like a 150-page book.
but I think that's perfect. So a sex worker could be a mom. She could be a pillar of her community in every other way, but the part of her identity that is a sex worker is discredited. And also, isn't it that becomes sort of totalizing of her? That part of your identity takes on like a master identity or whatever. Am I remembering Goffman right? You know better than me.
Yes. I always just very simply put it, their defining attribute, where
right.
This one part of their identity trumps all others.
Right, exactly. So for sex workers, they are only a prostitute. Or can we also just take 1 second to define sex work? What are we talking about here? Because that, I think, is like an important part of your thesis, too.
Yeah, so I use the word sex work just as an umbrella term for any sort of sexual labor, really, or any exchange of monetary value or something similar for sex. So I always, whenever I talk to people about sex work, I like to make this kind of connection between this umbrella fits everything from escorting to street-based prostitution to stripping, but also to like a sugar relationship where...
Oh, like a sugar daddy?
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
That's often not thought of as a form of sex work, but in some way, you are generating profit.
Totally. And couldn't you say marriage is a form of sex work?
If you want to get really fun about it, yes.
I always want to get really fun about it. So we know what sex work is. We know that it's absolutely stigmatized. We know that from the literature. And so what was your research question? So what were you trying to figure out?
So I basically wanted to know how this sex work related stigma was reproduced. Then in order to answer this research question, I employed one of my favorite methods, which is any sort of media analysis, and using the largest Canadian publication that is widely read, also minorly government funded, the CBC, as a means of looking at how these structures of stigma may kind of introduce themselves within to the reporting itself.
So how did you do that?
So I use two approaches because I don't like deciding on one method whatsoever. I combine something called content analysis, which is looking for broad patterns in any sort of media, with discourse analysis, which looks at the specific language that's used. And I paired them both together to basically analyze 100 news reports and find these both broad and micro patterns of stigma.
So can you just talk about like how you collected the data, just like quickly, but you know, how did you collect the data? How did you decide on which articles that you were like, how did you pick those 100? And then what did you do with those 100?
Yeah, so I basically started with finding a number that was both representative but not overbearing. So I looked at this range of dates. Any report that was published by the CBC that included sex work was included in a population, and then I whittled it down to 100.
Just by like random selection in Excel.
Yes, I used a very simple number generator that I Googled. And I chose 100 because the reports I decided on had certain criteria that they had to be long, and it totaled to about 85,000 words.
Oh my God.
So 100 is definitely still a monumental task. And I basically combed through them for language and words, and I created a coding frame where I looked for specific terms to find those broader patterns and then paid attention to how they were used.
So you did a kind of like quantitative summary, adding it all up. Then you also did this qualitative analysis. And then tell me a little bit more about the discourse analysis. And then I promise we will get to the findings because it's so interesting.
Basically, the discourse analysis was all about not only the language that was on the text, but how it was employed. And this is when I started blending theory with methods, and they became almost unable to exist without one another in the context of this project.
Amazing. And that was on like a smaller, like a subsample of like...
Yes, I chose 10.
Right, that were sort of key ones.
Yeah, they were the most, they had the most frequently observed patterns that showed up in the content analysis.
Okay, so what did you find?
So I found that sex work stigma used in news reporting was dependent on one of three narrative frames, okay, where sex workers were either framed as the villains, the victims, or the heroes within a story. And depending on that, your level of stigma, whether it's explicit or covert, was determined by this narrative frame.
I love it. And you borrowed that from the work of me who borrowed it from the work of Paul Surrett, I'll just say.
Yes. Because
I love giving credit to Paul Surrett and Kelly Gordon, who wrote an awesome book about abortion. But so what you're saying is that sex workers are being framed or sort of characterized, to use another word, as heroes, victims, or villains. Is there one that they were characterized as more than another? I can guess. I mean, I read it, but like one could guess. So tell me more.
Yeah, so basically explicit stigma showed up a lot in villain narrative framing. However, this was not super frequently observed. The most aggressively present was this narrative frame of the victim that often employed very covert levels of stigma and tended to talk about consensual sex work with human trafficking interchangeably. They're basically defined as the exact same thing within right. This narrative frame. And then the narrative frame of the hero showcased a lot more focus on sex workers discussing sex work and actively opposing sex work stigma. And so my final argument was that this was a form of stigma management and a way to oppose this discredited identity.
Interesting. I love that. I love research that really focuses on the people who are being shat on saying, I will not be shat on. There's this a way to manage the stigma is also a form of resistance to say, like, I am not just a victim here and I have agency. Is that fair?
Yeah, it was definitely a form of resistance. And you also saw a very different form of discourse begin to take form when you actually spoke to sex workers, where their work was framed much more casually and it was spoken about almost humorously. And the real critique came from the difficulties that policy has on their work rather than the work itself.
Interesting. Who would be the people quoted in the news stories that are doing the framing, like the villain or victim framing?
So I found a lot of police, government officials, and anti-human trafficking activists. And then when you actually speak to sex workers, they tend to be quoted more frequently.
Now, here is when I'm going to ask you a hardball question. So this is going to punch you right in the gut. So what about people who might say that, well, we're only hearing the voices of empowered sex workers. And that, how do we know that isn't just like a few super dynamo sex workers, but like there's 95% of sex workers are like cowering in their victimhood and the police are actually saving them. And these sex workers are like papering over the reality. What do you have to say to that argument?
I'd say there's kind of two different things within that singular argument. One, the reason you don't hear from a lot of sex workers is stigma. It's an incredibly stigmatized form of labor where disclosure is often quite dangerous, wherein the work itself is not the danger, but once you are labeled or discredited through being a sex worker, that is when the real danger comes in. The second half, human trafficking does exist. That is a reality. However, we've become so used to very exaggerated kind of statistics that have no citations or backing and really elevated discourse to maintain this marginalization of sex workers that it's really difficult to really discern like what exactly the argument is there.
Did you also look at like census data? There was something I remember at the defense you were talking about like StatCan measurement of occupations.
Yeah, I was talking about kind of the transformative potential of including sex work in research, where the Canadian census data doesn't actually have a subcategory when looking at occupation for any sort of sex work, and you're put into the other category.
Yeah, so who knows if there's 95% or it's impossible to know because nobody is collecting the data on it. And maybe that's also partly because it's stigmatized. Like the stigma becomes this sort of like vicious cycle. And also I think it's not helping people who are actually victims of trafficking if the career, the occupation, the job is so stigmatized that nobody will talk about it. Nobody will measure it in research. It's like we're addressing issues of human trafficking with the blindfold on, where we can't even, like, we don't even know what it is that we're doing. It, like, makes it harder. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, totally. It makes it harder because there's no focus.
Yeah.
Because we're focusing on two completely different things. We somehow make them some amalgamation of both that helps neither.
Yeah, exactly. And I think we talked before, like, there was that article that I saw somewhere when we were, like, in an early conversation. It totally changed my thinking on it and, like, blew my mind. Because I would definitely, you know, when I was, like, taking women's studies in the 90s, it was, like, I remember the video about, like, porn is always, like, bad and, like, everything. And we'll talk about porn, too. All of this is, like, bad for women and it's all evil. And yet there's all kinds of occupations, I think, that men engage in that have forms of human trafficking. And yet nobody is going to say, well, we shouldn't do that. So, like, fishing. Like, I saw this article in a newspaper that was talking about, like, this problem of like human trafficking in these like cross ocean vessels where there's like fishermen, because they'll like become basically indentured servants where they have to get a, you know, they have to pay for whatever to get on the ship. And then they're basically sometimes literally chained to the ship in order to like finish repaying it. And it's like, but nobody's out there being like, oh my God, we got to do something about fishing. Fishing is unsafe for men. Vulnerable men are getting trafficked as fishermen on the high seas. So we really need to end fishing and ban it. That doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, because it doesn't have the dirty word connected to it, which is sex.
Let's talk a little bit more about that. So, like, why do you think people are so afraid of sex, even though everybody wants to do it and everybody, like, is trying to? I mean, maybe not everybody. There are, like, we have to acknowledge there are aromantic, asexual people out there, and we love you and God bless. A lot of people, though, enjoy having sex. So why is it so hard, do you think, for people to talk about or think about it?
Well, I think kind of tying in a point that came out in my thesis was morality. We've been so swallowed by this idea of what is morally good and the notion that shame is acceptable, that it's just erased the ability to talk about sex, let alone have sex or have a constructive, any sort of action with sex.
Yeah. In your reading of the literature, why is sex shameful? Why is it something that is stigmatized?
If I had a direct answer to that question, I don't think we'd ever need to study sex, because we could just kind of snap our fingers and solve it. But it's really, I kind of point to two very different groups. There's the very kind of Christian religious very conservative mindset that sex is wrong, sex is sin. But then also we had, during the 1970s and 80s, a lot of progressive movements, including feminists. And as a feminist, it breaks my heart to say it, who started conflating certain sex acts with violence.
Yeah, and started working with Christians, evangelical Christians, in a very weird, like, marriage of social movements. But even before, like, why, and maybe this is like an impossible question, but I feel like I want to dig in just for a minute. What purpose does it serve even for Christians? I'm trying to get you to talk about, like, maybe Silvia Federici a little bit, who is, you know, one of my favorite authors, a little bit about, like, history of how we conceptualize sex work in particular. Can you just talk a little bit about that? And then let's talk about the feminists and your favorite feminist, Catherine MacKinnon.
Oh, yeah. My Stan account for Catherine MacKinnon will come to light. Yeah, basically, I always point to the word control, where so many structures of power realized as history progressed, sex is perhaps something that is transformative, that can be used as a form of resistance, so we must contain it, we must control it. And where Federici's work is really cool is that it ties it to the witch hunts, and where you really see patriarchy's kind of attempt to swallow in anything that isn't able to be controlled into this cage, and eventually burning the witch.
Yeah, and I think also, like, to me, what's so interesting too about her book, it's called, the book we're talking about is Caliban and the Witch, and it's all about primitive accumulation too, so it's like early capitalism, like when people were just starting to, like capitalists were starting to exist. And prior to that, it was, you know, there were landed elites like the kings and the knights and the lords, and then there was the church. And so there was this sort of this grappling for power between the emerging bourgeoisie, who were like owners of the means of production, whatever those means might be, as limited as they were at the time, with the sort of church and the landed elite. And so we also, with the church, there was this battle between a competing religious movement of the heretics. So the heretics were super, like, free love, and they were all kind of like poly and into sex. And so I think there's also an element of that's not fair, because this is like not what your thesis was about, but not to put you on the spot, but it's, to me, super fascinating that it becomes this sort of fight for control, like exactly what you're saying, like this fight for control over who gets to decide what's good, what's right, what's moral. But it also became this way to, like, hold back a social movement that was against the teachings of the church in general, which I think also then speaks to, again, your superhero favorite feminist ever, Catherine MacKinnon, because we start to see, like, we can see that happening again in the, like, late 1970s, early 1980s. So maybe tell us why you love Catherine MacKinnon. Just kidding.
Yeah, I'll kind of tie both together because they go hand in hand. The reason Federici's work was so illuminating to me is that sex work was actually state sanctioned in the Middle Ages as a deterrent for masturbation. Right. So it still goes back to shaming sex. But kind of taking that idea as this form of shame came the feminists of the 70s and 80s. And again, one of my least favorite theorists on this planet. I know she has some, like, positive contributions when it comes to the patriarchal notion of law.
Nobody's nerfect, as my sister says.
Exactly. But she basically decided that any form of porn is basically filmed violence. And it was only meant for men to, at one point in her book, put their dicks in their hands and watch the exploitation of women. So that's kind of ridiculous to me, because it's a similar argument to video games cause school shootings.
So, I mean, men do put their dicks in their hands and look at porn. So what's the problem with her argument? What's why is she wrong?
She basically uses this morality discourse where she thinks because, you know, a woman is sexually liberated and filmed being so, she must be exploited in that process.
Okay, another hard-hitting question that's going to punch you in the gut. Is there not portrayals of violence in porn? Are there not images of women being hurt or choked or, like, slapped? Is that not violence against women? I mean, like, you already said the thing about school shootings, but maybe tease that out more for me.
Yeah, so basically a lot of the imagery that you're talking about in pornography is just non-normative sex acts. Like, there is a whole list of sexual acts that people are into, a whole list of kinks that may seem kind of difficult to understand. However, in making pornography, there is a consensual process that runs the filming of pornography, especially if it's studio. In our current day, a lot of self-produced pornography makes you also sign consent forms where you know exactly the activities that will happen. So you're basically seeing just kind of sex acts that question what we think sex should look like. However, some people very much enjoy that. And that's why that porn is made. There is an audience.
Do you think that, I mean, again, it like goes back to the like fishing argument. It's like, so, you know, there can be bad actors in any, like capitalism is violence too, right? I mean, like working in a factory is violence. Like people get injured, like people get hurt. Like there are a lot of things that people do are unsafe. It doesn't necessarily mean that we want to say anyone who does that is bad or that anyone who does that work should never be allowed to do it. We need to like put in, as you just said, consent and make it so that it's something that people are, you know, to try to limit the exploitation that can happen. But I think, as you were saying before, the more something is stigmatized, the more it sort of goes underground, the less that we can try to make it be a safer workspace for the workers. Is that fair?
Yeah, definitely. And that's why I sometimes get very frustrated when people make the argument that porn is violent, because in a similar way that so many people conflate human trafficking with sex work, a lot of people conflate pornography with sex abuse material, and they are two very different things.
Let's dig into that a little bit, because I know like you have had, I want to give you space to like respond, because I know you have had all kinds of interesting feedback from students when you've been a teaching assistant or when you're like in classes. Like what are the kinds of arguments that people make? And if you could, you know, how sometimes we're like, I wish I would have said, but maybe you're very articulate, so maybe you always said exactly what you wanted to say. But like, what are the critiques people are making? What do you want to say back to those people?
Yeah, I mean, part of the problem is like, I mean, thank you for the articulate. I also find myself somewhat confrontational. So I'm totally down to debate when students bring these ideas up. But the big focus is either on exploitation, which I always remind them, you are looking at such a small subset of the population that, especially in the context of the work that I'm talking about, is not entirely relevant. That needs to be its own focus. The second always seems to come with porn addiction. Oh. That is the big topic everyone tends to bring up. And I remind them, a lot of the work on porn addiction is very similar to the work on any sort of addiction, where it's quite psychological. Sample sizes are very small. But also, I remind them, if you were to treat any addiction, do you shut down the industry or do you look at it individually?
Well, if it is the 1920s in the United States, then yes, you shut down the entire industry. But I think we all know that that did not. Prohibition was not successful in curbing drinking or violence.
Not at all. And the idea that some porn prohibition would solve all of the problems would just cause a lot of very unsafe practices.
Totally. It's interesting. You know, I'll just say I read an article that in Indonesia, if you like search for porn, it won't let you find anything. It's like really weird. You can't find it. And so I think it'd be really interesting. I mean, there's so many other factors and so many other variables, but that could be a future project that could be interesting to see like where there are porn bans, like what kinds of freaky things come out or what kinds of freaky things don't come out. Or are you telling me that like there's no violence in Indonesia? Like I adore Indonesia and it's an amazing, beautiful place. But like there's definitely been some problems of violence and corruption in that country. And it's not as though like there's no porn there. And so the patriarchy like left. It's like this idyllic feminist haven for all, you know?
Yeah. And that's why that argument does tend to aggravate me a little bit. Because again, like we tie sex to something and suddenly it's this very big, scary problem that we have to address by shutting everything down and shaming people into the corner. And we just spoke about the state-sanctioned sex work in the 14th and 15th century. It was to quell masturbation. The idea of prohibiting porn because you are too focused on watching it every hour of the day, masturbating.
Right. Like, yeah.
It's kind of a return to 500 years ago.
Yeah. Yeah. That's interesting. I actually, one of my favorite podcasts is this one called Science Versus, where it's very, it's like they're science people, and Wendy Zuckerman, who's Australian. There's my really bad Australian accent for my for my Australian friends out there. Anyway, she did one on porn addiction. It's really good, where it'll be like science versus anti-vaxxers, or science versus whatever. So this was like science versus, so where they really dig deep into like, what is the science on this issue? And it's been a while since I listened to it, but it was, seemed pretty clear that like porn addiction is not really a thing. It's that shame around masturbation is so strong that people who think they have sex addiction actually masturbate and engage in sex about as much as any other average person. They just think people are doing it less than they are, which I find fascinating.
Yeah, that is really interesting.
Yeah, it's like people masturbate a lot. So it's just like, if people are like, oh my God, I'm doing it all the time. It's like, no, you're normal, dude. It's like, you're just 17. And that's like, yeah. You know, like, that's just what people do. Look at bonobo monkeys. Evolutionary anthropologist Blaffer Hardy talks about this a bit. I think that's who talks about it. But that we are extremely close to bonobo monkeys, but it doesn't get talked about in research very much because they are hypersexual. They have sex all the time, but it's like they're constantly masturbating. So it's like you're less likely to see them in zoos because you want like the zoo. It's like you want little kids to come by. You don't want to see all these like monkeys jerking off like in behind the glass cage. Because of the shame around sex, we are limiting our understanding of human evolution and primatology. I find it so fascinating how much these kinds of social cultural ideas are influencing what's supposed to be quote unquote objective science or truth. You know?
Yeah. And that's why we still have, for some reason, celibate sex ed, where you really encourage, don't you dare have sex or else you'll get diseases and die.
Right.
Which is just so ridiculous, and a way to kind of move people away from having sex, when in reality, it pushes them into unsafe sex practices.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I still remember when, I think it was Joycelyn Elder. She was I think it was under Bill Clinton in the 90s. She was the Surgeon General, and she was trying to advocate for teaching about masturbation in schools. And it was like the evangelicals were like, no fucking way. Like, this is not happening.
Yeah, like sex is just something that happens. And like, my goal in life is just to demystify sex, because like, it's not something to be afraid of. It's not something that has to happen with other people. It's something to bring you pleasure. And then if you also share that pleasure with other people, ensure they are also having pleasure, because you don't want asymmetrical like orgasm encounters, because that sucks for the other person.
Right.
But at the end of the day, it's pleasurable. It's fun.
Right.
That's it.
I know. So let's talk a bit about what you're doing. Talk about taboos. You're now talking about MILF porn. So, mom, I'd like to fuck. So MILFs. I remember seeing American Pie, the movie. I think, that's where it was popularized.
It was used in, I believe, a study at UCLA once before that, in studying, I believe, like 16 to 19-year-old men. But then it was taken up by American Pie as a way to describe the eternal MILF, Jennifer Coolidge.
Oh, God, I love her. I always forget that it was Jennifer Coolidge.
Yeah.
Oh, my God, she's the best.
Leaning back in a chair in leopard print.
Oh, my God.
That's your MILF.
Oh, my God. She's my MILF. You're looking at MILF porn. So not just this sort of cultural idea, although I did send you that I was at the Metcalf Fair last weekend, a little country fair, and they had like this, you know, they have all the like shit you can buy that, you know, like whatever, sweatshirts and t-shirts with just hilarious things. But one, I really almost wanted to buy it, but it said I heart MILFs. And so instead I just took a picture and sent it to you. But like, it's right? But I was like, I kind of want to wear that. Why are you interested in this? And like, what is the deal with like, because also, again, let's say I read an article on this, but like, there's a lot of porn out there that's like stepbrother, stepsister, moms. What is with this sort of like incest porn stuff?
So like, I have so many parts to this answer.
Okay, yeah.
First, MILF porn is the most popular. For the last decade, MILF, mom, and stepmom were all in the top 5 search terms on many, many porn sites.
No, how do you know that? Where did you get that information?
There are reports that a lot of these websites, like Pornhub, for example, will release at the end of the year of most popular search terms, even search terms by territory.
No.
So you can see like, oh, what were people in Louisiana searching for in 2019?
Oh my God.
And yeah.
Is DILF a thing? Like,
dad? Not as popular. Everyone just wants to fuck their mom.
Tell me more.
So, like, very popular. I mean, so many of these videos have over 100 million views.
Wow.
And so, when you look at popular pornography, it's hard to even consider that without looking at the MILF. But also, you are looking at a subject that incest is not only, like, socially taboo, it's also illegal.
And I kind of am okay with that, personally.
Well, yeah. Like, it's a means of, like, ensuring that birth defects don't happen.
Yeah, and I also think the power... sexual harassment is real. It's like, I think it's very mm-hmm. problematic when someone who has more power engages in a sexual relationship with someone with less power. There's so much space for manipulation and controlling of what it fucks with your head of, like, what is true, what is untrue. There's secrecy around it. But I don't think it's just, like, to me, that's very different than, like, sex work.
Yeah, and that's why porn is so kind of great, because yes. it's just a space to live out fantasy. And it's why in MILF porn, you see the most exaggerated conceptualization of what a mother is. And it's to drive that fantasy and almost to separate you from reality so that you are still getting pleasure while it's also creating this almost paradoxical idea of motherhood. Because as children, you see your mother as this very sweet figure.
Not hopefully. My children.
Yeah. I was like, there are situations where that doesn't happen, but, you know, this, I guess, like, stereotypical version of a mother, they're wearing an apron, baking cookies, very sweet, very loving, very cherished, like, figure. But then turning that on its head and watching a mother have an orgasm brings so much of a, like, different pleasure.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and I guess it's also, like, MILF porn, or, you know, like, the idea in American Pie, it wasn't, like, people wanting to fuck their own mother. It was, like, the guys all wanted to fuck Stifler's mother. Like, I wonder if there's also a sense of, like, dominance over the friend, maybe? Like, I don't remember. Like, I'm not fucking my mother, but I'm gonna fuck your mother. You know, or it's, like, the bumper stick or whatever that's, like, my other ride is your mom or whatever, yeah. You know?
Like, it's basically, like, you want to fuck the cultural idea of the mother.
But is it, like, I mean, is it the cultural idea of the mother? I guess what I'm asking is it to dominate mothers? Is it to dominate other men? Like... is it, like, this idea of, like, you know, she's changing your diaper, but I am a grown man and you are a little baby boy. You know what I mean? This sort of emotional, mental sense of, like, domination, control. Mm. And not necessarily, like, and I'm saying this non-normatively, like, not to say, like, domination, control is inherently bad. Like, we all want to feel in control of our lives. Like, we want to feel like we have agency and autonomy. And so it's like sometimes it gets expressed as a, like, go fuck yourself while I'm fucking your mom. You know what I mean?
Yeah, totally. I think it's definitely all of that. I tend to go, like, so deeply sociological that's like, it's also almost fucking the patriarchy for putting mothers in this little box of you have to be sweet and cherished. And now they have just giant breasts popping out of, like, a leopard print bra.
I love that. Oh, I see what you're saying now. Yeah, like, I love that idea of, like, conceptualizing MILF porn also as a way to sort of reject the kind of, like, Betty Crocker, Leave It to Beaver kind of, like, conceptualization of, like, woman equals mother and mother equals domestic, loving, asexual provider of all of your emotional and physical needs.
Yeah, we're, like, moving away from the Brady Bunch, mm-hmm. where that type of family is not really the most sexually interesting, mm-hmm. and moving instead into this idea that we take those roles, turn them on their head, and now it's almost subverting these systems of oppression that really guide the shame that we feel around porn and the kind of insistence that this form of family is the right form of family.
Interesting. I have two questions. One is more of another hard-hitting gut puncher. And then another one is, if I can remember them. The other one is more, I'll do the hard-hitting gut puncher because now I'm forgetting what the other one was. So what about those feminists who might say, it's just the sort of old Madonna and the whore dichotomy, that women are just, our options are to be the holy mother or to be a whore who's providing sexual pleasure. And there's, like, how dare Phyllis suggest that that is, like, having some kind, or Tyler, either of us, that would be a symbol of agency. Isn't it just the Madonna whore binary? What do you say to that?
Well, I think one, binary thinking in feminism is so boring that I've kind of tried to move away from that and think of like...
That's a cop-out.
I know. I like to think intersectionally. It's much more fun. But also, I think the MILF is the answer because they are both the Madonna and the whore.
But don't women have... Aren't we... I mean, I kind of think that does describe me. But like, I also have taken a pickleball and I've been doing pottery throwing and I do research, obviously. Doesn't this porn suggest that all I am is a Madonna or a whore?
Well, that's why they also depict MILFs as mothers. There's a preamble in the porn that shows them doing everyday activities. It just gets turned on its head at one point and someone asks someone else to either get on their knees or bend over. And who's to say that's not a part of pickleball? I've never played it, but like, who's to say that doesn't progress in that way?
There's gotta be pickleball porn. I know that in...
There's porn for everything.
Oh my God, there's gotta be. And it's certain. Like, I mean, it's just so ripe for all kinds of plays on words, you know. One of my former students, Shannon Russell, did a work on sexual consent among students. And like one of them learned about sex because her aunt bought her the book, Tickle His Pickle. I'm like, there's gotta be a porn out there titled Tickle My Pickleball or something. Yeah, I don't know.
Or Dickleball is where I went.
Okay, yeah, I love it. Okay. I want to ask just a little bit about, like, now that we're talking about all these titles, porn seems like it's changed so much, too. Like, it used to be there was, like, you know, videos, and there was no, like, porn you could get in town because it was, like, this tiny town. So we would drive 45 minutes. There was a sex shop in Galesburg, Illinois, that was, like, at the edge of town, and we would, like, get in our cars and just, like, giggling, and then go to the sex shop and then giggle and look at everything, probably leave, and then, like, go to Denny's or whatever we couldn't get a hotel. It seems like it has shifted so that it's, like, people are searching for MILF porn, but it's not, like, this long film with going into whole, like, storyline. Has the nature of porn changed anything about it being sort of the storylines that are being developed, but also just in terms of like sociology of it, the labor market of it, you know, or even just things like OnlyFans or, as you said, more like women creators of porn, but also like people creating their own porn. How has that shifted and what do you think that means culturally, sociologically?
Unfortunately, like we have almost done away with porn theaters. That's always a funny thing to reminisce about.
Oh my God.
But that was one of the only places you could watch porn. Yeah. And so that progressed to home video where you could get a VHS or a DVD. But now that the internet has kind of boomed, you have this blend of both studio-produced porn as well as self-produced porn, which is, I think, very exciting. Most studio porn still have storylines. So that hasn't been entirely done away with. You can still see the 5-minute preamble. And on some popular porn websites, you can actually see where people skip to most often. But it seems like judging by that, they still watch the preamble most of the time because, again, the fantasy is hot.
Interesting.
Yeah. But if we're thinking sociologically, you know, the culture around porn is still kind of the same. It's just don't watch porn. That's bad for you. But also it's a really great kind of potential for a different idea of labor and self-produced labor. Because if you're making content, you're in charge of the production. You're also in charge of the money you get.
Yeah.
And it's almost turning capitalism on its head a little bit, even though you're still under the guise of a company like OnlyFans.
Yeah. I think it also really sort of points to the problem with your feminist icon. Sorry, I can't stop. It really provides pretty solid counter evidence to this idea that it is pure exploitation. There's so many people out there creating, like I was listening to another podcast, I forget the name of it, but it was like about the porn industry. And the problem for creators is not exploitation. It's that there is so much content, they can't make a living at it because it's like there's so much competition between people who want to make films or like videos or whatever else of themselves having sex. That like that's the hard part. And I think that they were also talking about something else, but it was talking about like someone who had an OnlyFans site and that it became important for them to start doing more sort of specialized content where it was sending texts of herself and then she'll like it'll be like directly sent like to a subscriber. Yeah. That it becomes much more this sort of there starts to be this kind of like I don't even want to say individual. What am I trying to say? Do you know what
like
I'm saying?
Like niche?
It's maybe. Niche, but it's also, it's like, it's not just like mass produced. It's like the money is going to be made if you can get a subscriber, a fewer higher end subscribers that you are fulfilling their fantasy so that they can sort of feel like the fantasy is a little bit more real. But it's still just like through their OnlyFans account, through texting or whatever.
Yeah, you know and that's very much the interpersonal sex work model that has worked for so long. It kind of harkens back to hiring a sex worker, where it's a personalized one-on-one experience. And bringing that into the porn space is almost calling back to that practice.
Yeah. And I think, because I like, it's so interesting because you can, like, again, that sort of thing I was saying earlier about, like, these lines between, like, well, what's good and what's bad. It gets so blurry. It's like, why are we trying to contain this? Again, I think sexual violence against minors, that is bad. Rape, non-consensual sex, that is bad. But there's, like, all of the, like, contours of kinks and desires of what you're into. That just feels like, why are you taking away something that's just fun?
Yeah, it's because, you know, that feels not normative. And that challenge is really disorienting at times.
Yes, totally. And I think it also is, I do feel like there's a relationship with the capitalism, with religion, where and power, like you were saying earlier about like power and control, that it also becomes this separation between our bodies. It's like if we can separate our desires and we can, it's like we're gaslighting ourselves. It's, you know, or like the porn addicts where it's like they're not actually addicted. They just have normal behavior. Then it's like this collective gaslighting where we can start to disconnect from our true desires about other things where it's like, oh my God, I am being overworked at my job here. And instead of saying, you haven't hired enough profs here, I am stressed out and I keep going on burnout leave. And I think, oh, there's something wrong with me. Oh, like I should be a better professor. I should organize my time better. I need to have a better calendar. And then I look around people who have a normal life and I'm like, oh my God, this isn't my problem. This is that there aren't enough professors at this university to like cover all the students, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I think it's like I wonder about how much our the sort of shame about sex is a way to just train us from a very early age to like, don't trust your body. Don't trust, like, don't listen to your body. Don't believe in your body. Definitely don't enjoy your body. Like, your body is not something to enjoy. Your body is something to be used by others. But also, we're going to critique this idea of it being used. It's like, we're going to use it in these particular ways, but you don't get to decide how you're going to use your body.
Yeah, you just put so eloquently why I don't like anti-porn feminism. Because at once you're fighting to not have your body used, but also encouraging the suppression of use of your body. It is one of the most confusing, very circular, ridiculous arguments. Yeah. But no, I think this, like, shame is always what I tend to go back to.
Yeah.
Where we are so
shame on shame. Exactly. Shame on shame.
But we're so used to shame overtaking the idea of release, if we're talking about sex, or pleasure, that we just accept the shame. And we never do anything to resist it.
Yeah, because it's shameful to resist it. We don't want to get in trouble. We don't want to be told, oh, you're inappropriate. You're doing something wrong. And if we, it's exactly what your point was in the beginning. It's like, if we're not talking about it, if we're not like admitting the truth, then how the fuck are we supposed to deal with the problems that come up that are like real problems, you know?
Exactly. And that's why my work is definitely going in the direction of studying pleasure, because I think one of the very few universal experiences that we have is pleasure. And I focus on sexual pleasure, but there's lots of different pleasures that, you know, those with power want to suppress.
Totally.
But embracing pleasure is a way to resist, a way to transform.
Oh my God, I fucking love it. And that is why I'm doing pottery and playing pickleball lately. Exactly. It's because I'm like, I'm not just a worker. I want to have fun. And yet I still feel guilty. It's like, because I see coworkers, colleagues, like working a lot. And I'm like, I hope they don't like feel bad. And maybe I'm inspiring them to also, we need more people playing pickleball too, because I know it's like stupid and suburban, but it's so fun. It's actually fun because you don't have to like run the whole time mm-hmm. and you get lots of breaks. That's like the kind of sport that's I'm into. Excellent. Right? Anyway.
It's like good tennis.
Exactly. And not like impossible like table tennis, which always I just get flustered by. Anyway, this has been amazing. Is there anything else you want to say before we wrap up?
I hate telling people to just go have sex or watch porn because I think that's quite crazy. But why? No, honestly,
people should go have sex. I mean, go watch porn. Do whatever you want.
If that's what you like, explore your interests.
Right.
Have fun, orgasm, like bring yourself pleasure.
Yes.
But also just talk about sex. Yes. That's always the point I bring back to people that I talk about my work with is the more we talk about sex, the more readily it's available for us to study and embrace ourselves.
I love that. This was amazing. It was so fun. Like this was like to really get more in depth about the ideas. This was awesome. Maybe we should just every meeting with all the grad students, it'll just be a podcast episode.
There you go. A great idea. Yeah, this was fun. And this is why I wanted to stick around for this degree, because you're just so much fun to talk to and talk about sex without everyone getting weird.
I know. Although sometimes I feel a little weird inside, but I try to just like, I shame myself and then I'm...
Well, there we go. We have some years to work on that inner shame and then we'll knock it right out.
Exactly. Well, you inspire me to like... Be a goddamn grown-up, Phyllis. But anyway, I love it. No, but it's so interesting. So anyway, thank you so much for coming on my podcast. And thanks everybody for listening. If you liked this episode, please give us a 5-star rating on your favorite podcast platform and write even just like one little sentence, be like, I like sex or Tyler rules. You could just put that just to like, you know, those algorithms or whatever. This would really help us to reach more listeners and make doing social research within the reach of everyone.